Welcome as we gather this morning for Bible study. I'm David Vasquez. I'm a campus pastor at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And Julia, who's scheduled to do the Bible study this week, as some of you know, has not been feeling well. She had to go into town yesterday, and the boat doesn't get back till noon. So we have not confirmed how she's doing today, so hopefully she'll be able to come back and rejoin the conversation starting tomorrow. But I'll have the privilege of having our conversation this morning on for the Bible study. And then if she recovers and is able to come back tomorrow, then she'll join us for that. Otherwise, you may get to hang out with me for the rest of the week and do this. So I'm married to Carla Sumala, so there's some continuity between yesterday and today. Mostly that's it. Today, somebody asked earlier, we're going to talk about Paul. If it happens, it happens. But actually, we're going to focus on the book of Ruth. So we'll shift gears a little bit from the discussions about Paul. If you find some connections, please bring them along, whether it's Paul in the Bible or any other Paul you know. But I'd like to take a look at the book of Ruth and just to kind of read through that together. What might help our conversation might be a little bit of social engineering, so I'm going to ask you, those of you who are a little further back, if we can fill in a little bit more of the front here so I don't feel so lonely. So this will help us be in a circle of conversation. It's quite appropriate that we have Bible study conversations in this space and in this shape of a space. The biblical text, particularly the narrative parts of it, it was intended to be stories told around a fire. So imagine a nice little fire here. I love the way that the greenery here. Exactly. And the greenery sort of makes it look a little bit like a fire. So, but the book of Ruth is certainly one of those. It's a great story. I imagine it probably has, and most people I am in conversation with, the book of Ruth really is one of those just great stories. It's really a great story, so it's fun to read through it. So we'll start out with a word of prayer, and then begin our conversation this morning. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. Gracious and merciful God, you are the one who follows us around in a tent, pitching a tent among us, guiding us at times of darkness with a column of fire, and in times of brightness and joy with a column of clouds and glory. We ask you, O God, that we may know of your presence, and when we are unable to see you or feel you, we may walk in community together. We pray for Julia as she recovers, and we pray, O God, for our time and conversation today as we learn from the example of Ruth, of her faith, and of her loyalty and invitation. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. How many of you live today in the place where you were born and raised?
Generally.
Well, the city or town where you were born and raised, close enough to it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, about 9. Somewhere a little bit, we start moving as we move away from it, probably more hands would go up. So my guess, estimate here, it's somewhere around a third of us are still living perhaps within the area where we grew up, or were born and were raised. The majority of us have moved. And maybe those of you who are living near where you grew up and were raised have spent at least a portion of your life probably away from those places. As mobility and migration, it's a part of our lives today, more so than it ever has been in the history of the world. We are the largest group of people in the move today in the entire history of the world, more than there were after World War II, where even the very concept of refugee was, sort of the modern concept of the refugee was defined. So migration and mobility is a reality in our lives, to the point that one of the most common questions we encounter, particularly in a place like Holden, is what?
Where are you from?
Where are you from? As soon as you meet somebody at the dining room table in Holden, or walking around, even sometimes even before you ask the question of what your name is, I mean, there is this urgency to ask, where are you from? Why do we ask that question?
See if they're where we're from. Or in our area or someplace we've been. Somebody used the word connection. Connect with people.
So part of it is that it helps us identify and place people into some kind of a grid we carry around in our minds. And in that grid, there's lots of connections, so it helps us to be able to identify the person. What does it tell us about them if they, you know, if there is a connection? What happens to you physically as soon as they answer the question?
Depends on if you do have the connection.
Mm-hmm. So what happens if you do have a connection?
A commonality.
Mm-hmm. You draw close.
Mm-hmm. So physically you might move a little closer, you know, maybe relax a little, mm-hmm. or get some excitement, you know, about, oh yeah. What does it... Yeah, exactly. Immediately, all these images come into mind to try to further that connection. Right. You know, and so there is some newness that kind of allows us to interconnect a little bit more with that person, to place them a little more. There's a sense of relaxation about the relationship. What happens if we don't know where they're from, never been there?
We ask them about it.
Try to find out about it.
Try to find out about it. So there's a different kind of excitement, perhaps, you know, some interest in the way that this goes. Do we ask the question differently? Okay, I mean, I guess I'll say, I think we ask the question differently depending on where we're at. At Holden, it's a common question. Probably if you live in a small town, it's kind of a ridiculous question most of the time. If you're in a small town where you know everybody, when do you ask that question?
Someone new arrives.
Is there any way that it sounds differently? Is there any different part emphasized?
Where are you for?
You're not one of us.
Of course, at Holden, nobody is one of us, right? There's a way in which we're all, you know, the next question might be, so are you staff or are you just here for the week, you know? Then we kind of go into that, but there's a sense in which nobody really has an ownership of the place in the same way that we might in some other places. And that, you know, there's some great value to that kind of ownership and rootedness. There's certainly something about the fact that asking the question of where are you from immediately translates into saying there's a shift here as to who you are.
But then in large urban areas, I mean, you know, from Los Angeles, you don't even care where they're from. You don't even acknowledge the other person. It's like even if you say, certainly if you see somebody and say, hey, how you doing, you really don't want an answer. And if it's somebody you haven't seen, why waste your time finding out where they're from? Because They're nobody to you anyway. You assume there's no connection. Mm-hmm. Though if you actually stopped and talked to someone, you might be surprised. But a whole nother perspective on where are you from, it's, I don't care.
Yep. And so some of it is, it is an indication as well, even in a context where there is familiarity, and it's somebody who's a stranger or an outsider to the community, that there is some interest, some vested interest in knowing why this person is here. They're likely to want to have some connection with you in that community, a connection that is harder sometimes to build in areas, you know, in large urban areas as well, where everybody is likely to be from somewhere else. You know, we've seen a huge shift in the country for people towards urban areas, not only, you know, what we may think of as migration, people crossing countries, to come to the United States, but there's certainly huge migrations from rural areas to urban areas, so that, you know, a lot of places, nobody is really from there. I mean, nobody's really from Florida, right? I mean, everybody's just mostly, they're all mostly from Minnesota. Depending on where our conversation goes this week, we'll talk some more about this idea of migration and also tomorrow night, we'll offer a conversation about a situation that happened in Postville, Iowa, about 20 minutes from where we live and work at Luther College. And so I invite you to do that part of the conversation. So some of this we'll rehearse again there. So keep it quiet. Let's think for a moment, shift gears a little bit, and think about biblical characters. Just name out any biblical characters that come to mind. Let's try to name them out quick.
Moses.
Joel.
David.
Esther.
Abraham.
Naomi.
Isaac.
Mary.
Jonah.
Okay, what do all these people have in common?
Paul.
There we go. We got Paul there. We're talking about Paul. What do all these characters have in common? mean, lots of things, but
they're in the Bible.
Yeah. Right. What else? Huh? They're moving. They're all immigrants. Every single biblical character, I mean, I shouldn't say that so generally. I'm sure there's some that never migrate. But the majority of biblical characters all migrate. So let's think about some of the ones that we mentioned. To what extent does Paul migrate? Let's start with that. All over the place. Yeah, so he goes on missionary trips everywhere, you know, gets chained and brought up to Rome towards the end of his life. Who else? What other folks
Paul
are talking
about? Paul migrates from being a rabbinical Pharisee to being a Christian evangelist.
So there's also a physical, and sometimes the two go hand in hand. There's a physical migration that sometimes gets reflected in a, you know, spiritual journey or transition. And in many cases, you know, it's kind of hard to know which is first. You know, why is it that God asked Abraham and Sarah to leave? Why can't God fulfill whatever God's promises are going to be where they're at? There seems to be a need for some kind of a move physically that then eventually might lead to some kind of a spiritual transition. I mean, that's part of the wisdom of pilgrimages within most religious traditions. We can go through all of these stories, from Jesus himself to every single character in the Bible that we pick, has an experience of migration in their lives. You know, they have a significant move at some point in their lives. And that's the case also in other religious traditions. You know, migration permeates most religious traditions, major religious traditions. In Islam, just to give a couple of very brief examples, one of the pillars of Islam is to travel, to make the Hajj, to go to Mecca. And that is mirroring the Prophet Muhammad's own journey to Mecca, which was transformational in his life. If you look at this, at Buddha, the princess that eventually became the Buddha, is sitting pretty in his kingdom, ignoring everybody. And it's through a migration, through a journey through all of his lands. He leaves everything that's familiar to him and walks around his territory that begins his journey to enlightenment. And so for some reason, and that's part of what we'll talk about this week, for some reason, there seems to be an openness to people who are experiencing physical migration, some kind of openness to the divine. And the book of Ruth is an immigrant story. It's a story of an immigrant woman. There's actually two shifts of migration in it that we'll talk about today. We'll focus on verse 1. It is Naomi and her family that migrate one way, and then it is Ruth who migrates back with them. And so they both live as foreigners in two different lands. And that becomes really significant to keep in mind as we read our way through the book. Any comments or questions before we kind of start reading?
We have the original migration, of course, to Adam and Eve.
Yeah, exactly. They got kicked out of, they grew up in their territory and they were kicked out of it. And we see in that story, we see the polarity. You know, basically, there's different terminology that's used for this, but often people talk about the pull and push of migration. People are either pulled towards something, you know, a new opportunity like Abraham and Sarah for a promise, or they are pushed, as literally as it gets with with Adam and Eve, getting pushed out of the garden. So people either are running away from something or moving towards something.
Something to look at is, as a source of the reason for migration, as Jesus said, a prophet's not welcome in his own home. There's a very good reason to move out and to find new ears to listen.
Exactly. Sometimes, you know, the way that, you know, what Jesus is told right before is like, you know, who do you think you are? You know, and that's the reading actually for this coming Sunday, where the people around him get to say, isn't this the son of Joseph? You know, there's a way in which we'll get a different reception sometimes in a different community than our own. We get to reinvent ourselves sometimes when we ourselves migrate. You can try at least to leave your past behind. It has a way to follow you. If we can have a couple of folks read, we're going to read just the first 5 verses of Ruth. And Ruth is sandwiched between the book of Judges and the book of Samuel. So it's kind of hard to find because it's only like 2 pages long. So you have to kind of really, and in most, I don't know if I have the same Bible as many of you, but it's 267 on this particular version of the Bible. 244 in another one, so.
231.
Well, somewhere around the two somethings. So once you have found that, if we can have someone just kind of read through, maybe through verse 2, and then somebody pick it up and do 3 to 5.
In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephraimites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there.
Somebody just keep reading.
But Elimelech was the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left there with her two sons. These two Moabites' wives, the name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. When they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband.
What did you notice in that? Anything that stood out to you in those first five verses?
All the men died.
All the men died. Just a list of some of the things that we noticed, and then we'll kind of come back to them individually.
They moved because of the famine.
Okay, so famine. So there's a bit of a push there for them, yeah. And so all men. What else did you notice?
The two daughters-in-law from Moab.
Mm-hmm. So they married Moabites, okay.
They seemed to move repeated. So they were Ephraites from Bethlehem, and now they're moving again.
Mm-hmm. So there's movement in their past already. There's a sense in which it very quickly, you know, we talked about when you introduce yourself, you know, the question about where are you from helps us sort of organize. Well, what we're getting here is where they're from. And we get that they're Ephraimites. Ephraimites means that they're from the tribe of Ephraim. And so people would immediately know as they hear the story around the fire, they start placing who these people are. You know, the tribe of Ephraim, that means a lot. There's a whole history behind what that means, you know? It's just like when we are asking that question, where are you from? And they say, I don't know, L.A. I mean, that just sort of opens up a whole can of worms to what that means, you know?
Is that a Jewish tribe?
Yes, it's one of the 12 tribes of Israel. So there's 12, you know, the 12 children of Jacob become the 12 tribes of Israel. Ephraim is one of them. So Ephraimites are one of the tribes.
They assimilated into Moab rather quickly and well. The sons took Moabite wives. And
Yeah. Assimilation seems to be a part of it. Of course, I think that this is one of the parts that I think is really interesting, because when you put the two together, of the men dying and the assimilation, you kind of have to wonder. Are we told why the men died? No. We have no idea. Yeah. Doesn't that seem like an important little detail to provide? I mean, this is like, you know, from the get-go, this tells you, this is a story about women. The men are gone and nobody really cares. So, because we're not given a lot of detail. Why wouldn't we be given a lot of detail? And why wouldn't somebody ask? I mean, somebody eventually redacted this story and wrote it down. You know, as they kept telling the story over and over again, it gets refined, it gets perfected, until it finally gets written down. So why do you think there wouldn't be any detail about this? I mean, this seems fairly significant. It will shape the rest of the story. Yay. And we get lots of detail about other parts of the story.
The writer was more concerned about telling what the women did.
Mm-hmm. So part of it is the emphasis of the story. So it does really want to emphasize what's important here. What we want to talk about is what happens to these women, and we don't want to spend too much time with the guys. So that's maybe a part of the reason. What other things might contribute to it?
Well, I wonder if it has to do with the very first sentence as well. In the days when the judges ruled, and I don't know exactly how it would have been heard, but knowing what I know of the book of Judges, I wonder if it's similar to saying, like, how we would hear during the Dark Ages, or if you heard someone say, well, in the weeks after 9/11, whatever came after that, you would qualify. And so if the time of the judges was a time of this tribal warfare and a lot of instability, both political and otherwise, and also a cycle of faith and unfaithfulness, I wonder if just that first sentence welcomes us into this whole...
Very much.
And I want to connect it with what you were talking about with men and women, is
this is a very vulnerable family if the men are gone,
yep.
by the rules of the ancient world. So not only do you have a situation of that judge's instability, you have a family that's painting a picture of a really vulnerable situation for these characters.
That's awesome. That's very exactly, you know, at least my understanding of part of why we don't hear this details. And I'll put it in this context. When you think about the question, where are you from? What we're trying to do is we're trying to go from the possibility of being anywhere in the world. I mean, depending on looks, that question is already framed by what the person looks like. You know? Because in our minds, we already have assumptions. We're starting to reduce the world to where we think they're likely to be from based on what they look like. You know? I mean, that's just a part of how we categorize. You know, and there's some issues with it, but that's the way we function in the world. So being aware of it is significant. So we begin to do that, and so we go from the world to the specific. What we're trying to get to is the personal. And in this story, in five verses, notice how much we've already covered. We've gone from this situation that is global. The nation is coming out of the spirit of the judges. And you're very right in the way that the judges is a throwaway phrase if we don't pay attention to it. But it meant everything to the people who would have heard it initially. It was the Dark Ages. It was a period of a great struggle. The book is significantly placed in the canon between the Judges and 1 Samuel. That's not likely when it was written. I mean, the story probably started to circulate perhaps around that time. It's written later, and we'll talk about that at the end as to why, you know, when the story may have been written and why. But the event is taking place in this hugely transitional period of turmoil for the people of Israel. We know the story of them going with Abraham and Sarah and the whole thing, and then we've got them, you know, we have Jacob eventually, and then Joseph, and then they all end up in Egypt, and then they leave from Egypt with Moses. They're out wandering in the desert, and they finally get to the Promised Land. It is Judges who rule them there. This was the Promised Land. They've made it, but things fall apart when they tried to settle. And then eventually it gets so bad that against God's will and the prophet's warnings, the people ask for a king. And that's where we will eventually go. So this is a pivotal place. As I was walking with my kids in the, you know, on the little trails, you know, they point out to the avalanche chute. You know, this is the avalanche chute, where you have two major mountains, the judges on one end and the kings on the other. All the snow piles up in this tiny little book that comes at us. And it begins with that very simple phrase. In the time when the judges ruled. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, what happens right after that? What's the next little phrase? I mean, in the time of the judges,
there's a famine.
There's a famine. So I mean, with that just phrases, we're painting very quickly the effect of these phrases, and I appreciated that image, is this is right after 9/11 in New York. I mean, and so we're getting the kind of emotional connection that this would have evoked in those who would listen to the story.
The Moabites are not Jewish.
The Moabites are not Jewish, and not only are they not Jewish, but if you read the Judges and you read Kings, Moabites are part of the problem. The Moabites are hated enemies.
So why would they move to the Moabites?
Well, exactly, my next question. Why would you move to Moab?
It's like the last
food work.
Do you want to move there?
No.
That is clearly in the Gideon story. It's never told. But they did not want to move at all. This was not their first choice. They didn't want to just, you know, go to have new adventures in Moab. You know? This was the absolute last thing they could possibly have wanted to do. You know, it is only despair that forces them to do this. This combination of a famine, of bad political turmoil and bad leaders, of, you know, a crisis that's personal, and then who knows what else is going on that they choose to go to Moab.
I don't know much about Elimelech, but it may also speak to his faith that he was so willing to intersperse with the enemies of the Jewish.
So that there is a sense of trust in this person who will become an immigrant. I mean, nobody else, I mean, others may have left. We don't know about them. There's something that we'll need to attend to when we come back later in the story, because when they come back, the two women alone, you know, then all of a sudden there's family there, and family with resources. Where were they? You know, at this beginning of the story, that, you know, part of the family. We have lots of family issues. There is particularities to this family that we can read in different ways. Do we admire their courage for leaving everything behind and going? Will they have been viewed by those who are listening as traitors because they left, you know, in a time of crisis, and instead of sticking it out with everybody else, they went into the enemy? I mean, oftentimes when you look at the story of David, David follows the same pattern. He joins the Philistines for part of the time and actually fights with the Philistines mm-hmm. against Israel. Mm-hmm. Why did the men die? Did they die in battle, fighting for the Moabites? Were they killed in Moab because they're in enemy territory? We don't know. And I think that the story is intentionally unclear about what happened to these men. But it certainly does not develop warm fuzzies for the Moabites at the beginning of the story. So we begin the story by saying there's this major crisis and the people are going to this hated territory. Can you imagine who would be the Moabites for us today? Can you imagine?
Iran.
Iran?
North Korea.
So what would move someone to move currently to North Korea or to Iran?
Nothing.
And we can't imagine anything. And certainly the first listeners of the story would have felt the exact same way. What's that?
Missionary zeal.
Missionary zeal sometimes. Yeah. I mean, people have moved themselves out of faith, like you said, a little bit.
They wouldn't let
faith.
Us in the first place, I don't think.
What's that?
Iran.
Oh, come on, Steve.
Let us in. Probably will let us in.
Well, I'm assuming Moab wasn't exactly in open borders at the time to Jews either, to Israel. So you're right. I mean, it would have taken some serious struggle to get across that border. I mean, think about it. If there is famine over in Israel, I mean, there's nothing exactly that's going to divide that famine physically from what's happening in Moab. Maybe a little better in Moab, but I'm assuming the economic downturn is affecting Moab to some extent. This famine is impacting them. And so do they want to receive extra people at this time of famine? I mean, so it probably would have been very difficult in that time. Maybe it's not the exact same image, and I'm going to have border control and all that stuff, but there's certainly going to be some difficulties on the receiving end. All of this is generated and sort of at least brought up in that very beginning. When you think about the question of where are you from, the answer, even if brief, carries so much of it. You can just say, you know, well, I'm from Stuartville, Minnesota. Just say that, right? But that means an awful lot. I'm not telling you. I'm not telling you all that that means and what my family means in that town and its history in it. You're not going to know all that much about me by just saying that. But it reveals a little bit, depending on how much I know about Stuartville, Minnesota.
Well, Iran is a really extreme place, but I think within our country, if you are a Lutheran and you move to Utah mm-hmm. and had to suddenly become in the culture of the Mormons, mm-hmm. or with us, we moved from Colorado to Baltimore, and it took 5 years for me to feel like a part of that culture, that it was home. I was an outsider mm-hmm. for a number of years. I never had any friends that were locals. Mm-hmm. They were all people from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. And so there's clearly, you know, it's a matter of degrees to the extent to which we will not be welcome and how much of a toll a move will take on us. But there are certainly some patterns in any migration, in any move that we ourselves have experienced. There's some elements that we can relate to. You know, I think in some ways, whether it's physical migrations or, as you pointed out, some of the psychological or spiritual or developmental migrations that we experience, there's some commonality in the ways that we experience movement in our lives. You know, some of the things that both it opens us up to and some of the challenges we encounter when we do it. Sometimes even within the same country. Here in the NICU.
This comment reminds me, or makes me think what I was thinking earlier. There's a time scale to these questions as well. Mm-hmm. So here we, you know, everyone is where you're from, but the next question is when did you get here? Mm-hmm. And you know, when I was asked that on Saturday when I first got here, I felt like I'm just a new person. I don't know anything. I haven't come yet.
It's in the wisdom of the village, I think, to mark and to name migration here regularly because it is part of the daily pattern. I don't know how the staff puts up with it. And then, you know, to do this day in and day out for the rest of, you know, for an entire summer, my God. But it's hugely valuable to those of us who are coming and going out of the village quickly. But it does have a funny kind of impact about how quickly we do become at home in the place, you know, in part because the village welcomes us in that way. But some of it is the naming of that change, you know, of being the one being received and then quickly being the one receiving. And as you are just done, you know, yesterday I was walking up the hill and seeing some people starting to bring their luggage down, you know, so like a daily reminder, okay, we are here temporarily.
I was a career naval officer, and as this woman pointed out, but we moved 13 times in 30 years, and so we lived in lots of different places. And frequently, it was the church that was home right away, and friends and people we could count on and trust. And it took, well, sometimes we weren't in a place long enough to really become a part of the community. Now we've lived in San Luis Obispo, California for 23 years. We feel like we're part of the community. It took some years till you fit into a small town like that.
And you're appreciative of those communities that do make that transition bearable, you know, at times.
And then, of course, in this particular case, they left they left their culture. Mm-hmm. They left their religion and went into a place that was entirely different as far as the culture was concerned.
And their faith communities, you know, and again, Moabites, and I'll come to you in a second, the Moabites, not only are they foreign, you know, an enemy force, but there's also a concern about religious purity, you know. And like I said, we'll talk a little bit towards the end about some of the context in which this book is written, where, you know, one of the pieces in that is the fact that there is a concern about foreign influences in Israel worship, you know, and so they are not likely to find a synagogue in Moab. Well, there wouldn't have been exactly synagogues at the time, but they're not going to find reinforcement for their faith tradition or a welcoming environment in that way. They'll have to make that. But it also does raise the question about the church's role in welcoming anybody who's an immigrant, whether they're coming from across the state or whether they're coming from across the country or across the world. You know, what is the role of the church? And one of the puzzling things in our current discussions around immigration is that today we have while there's large diversity in the immigrant population, the predominance of them are Christian. But that element doesn't seem, you know, there isn't a sense in which they feel or find themselves, you know, that the church is the place where they'll feel totally welcome. Some do. Some experience that in particular congregations that open their doors to them. But many can't just assume that the church is going to be the place where they can, you know, just automatically connect because they share a history, they share a faith, they share these narratives. So,
well, or you know, in my mind, I was wondering if they were actually sympathizers. You know, if they actually could have gone because they actually were kind of on the other side. Mm-hmm. And in that immigration story, I mean, to me, it would be, again, would the door be closed even if they were sympathizers because they looked different? And,
no. And you know, and this is a territory where people, their looks may not have been hugely as significant, but people find ways to identify who's a stranger. May have been clothing, accent, language, lots of other ways in which they would have been identified as foreigners in the community they're going to. But what's significant to at least keep in mind is, you know, there is a choice that this group is particularly making. It may be a very forced choice, and it's not necessarily one that everybody else made. And their choice will be questioned by many. They themselves will question. Naomi will come back later in the story and say, no longer call me Naomi, which means happy and rejoicing, call me Mara, because I am bitter, because I've lost everything. She will regret that move. You know, she will say, I went with hands full and I've come back empty-handed. Well, she didn't really leave with the hands full. I mean, it was major crisis famine, but she had family. And she's coming back, having lost her husband and her children. This move was hugely costly to her. And a huge disappointment to her. So there is something about their particular family and their choice to move, and it does, I think, begin to break this clarity about who's a foreigner and who's an insider, who's an outsider and an insider. There is likely some connections. I mean, Moabites and Israelites probably had a lot more connections than they like to acknowledge. There's probably relationships across. I mean, just like when we decide where we're going to put the border here, it's not like automatically all the families on either side then stop being family. You know, there's people on both sides of every border, North and South Korea. You know, there's all these stories of people where siblings ended up on one side or the other, and all of a sudden they're part of two different nations. You know, certainly our southern border to the United States keeps bouncing up and down, you know, all over the place over history. Now it seems more settled, but it really hasn't been for long periods of time. And so where it moves, and the relationships, you know. This was a huge conflict. What happened at the Alamo, right? You know, our history and the way we remember it, it should at least be remembered with this kind of uncertainty about who's in and who's out. It's not always that clear. Mm-hmm. Dorothy?
I just wanted to say that tomorrow there's another session by Jody Kretzman, who's a community organizer, about communities that are willing to include strangers mm-hmm. from a community organizing perspective. Just to make that connection.
Good. So lots of good ways to explore and expand this conversation. So let me kind of move to a little bit, continue on with the with this portion of the story a little bit. On some of the other things that we noticed at the beginning, they married Moabite women. And again, what does that mean? Some of it is assimilation. What else does that
say? Would it mean that they were rich? I mean, why would they come into a new place and be... it just seems like they must have been a wealthy family to be able to move, to be able to cross the border, and then to have folks who were considered enemies marry them.
You know, there's really kind of a complexity to try to understand what's happening here, and it almost seems like people migrate at the extremes. Either people who have a lot of wealth and the ability to move, or people who are so desperate they don't have a choice. And it's hard to know where they're at. In some ways, it seems, by the context of the story, that they're probably more on the poor side of it. So it is puzzling that they would be married local women, because they have to be able to provide some kind of a dowry. They got to be able to make it worth it, unless they end up marrying at the bottom of the rung in the culture that they have come into. You know, that's also, you know, part of possibility. All of these things are unanswered in the text. Again, these are just simple little phrases. Where are you from? Well, just from, you know, just from Bethlehem.
If they had children, would they have been Jewish?
Well, the development of the Jewish line is actually a later development in some ways. It's really, you know, not that clear, but it is by and large matrilineal. In Jewish tradition, it's matrilineal. That will, you know, if you look at the Exodus story, that's where that begins to kind of solidify that you are a Jew in the Jewish tradition if you're born to a Jewish mother. And some of it gets, again, the context of the story is significant. I'll just throw it in now rather than wait till the end. Scholars believe that the book of Ruth was written down, not that the story began there. You know, the story probably had been told for a long period of time, but it became a significant central story to the tradition in a significant period. This was during the Ezra and Nehemiah, you know, post-exilic reform. The Jews, again, are in another time when they come, somebody takes them off into exile, and when they come back, they have this major fear of trying to clean things up. Ezra and Nehemiah bring in this reform where one of the things they're asking people to do is what? Does anybody know? What does Ezra ask people to do?
Divorce your foreign wives.
Yeah. Divorce your foreign wives. You've got to get rid of all those foreigners. There's this huge anti-immigrant, anti-foreigner sentiment in the culture and the fear. The same fear that is in the first chapters of Exodus. The sense of these foreigners who for a while were contributing, right? They came with Joseph and they contributed to the land. I mean, Joseph saved the nation, right? All of their contributions become a problem because now there's too many of them. And we got to get rid of them. And it is fear that begins to drive that. A similar thing then happens. That's in Egypt. And now the nation, as they come back from exile, gets into this, you know, anti-foreigner sentiment. And they say, divorce your foreign wives, get rid of them. Foreigners are bad. Trying to make this clear distinction between who is an insider and an outsider. And then the story comes in the middle of it. The story is told where a Moabite wife who's been, you know, and think about what's happening. We have a very vulnerable, we'll talk a little bit about gender too. This is a huge thing in the book. This vulnerable group. And what does Ruth say at the end? And again, we'll come back to some of this. At the end, the women in town tell Ruth, she's better to you than seven sons. I mean, this is hugely significant about a foreign wife is better to the mother-in-law. That's a tough relationship to begin with in this, many of the stories. It is in many of the stories. It's a great relationship with the mother-in-law.
Our country started, a few people took Native American wives mm-hmm. and once in a while tried to take them home.
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes would not. You know, oftentimes they were abandoned or, you know, the children were just, they just had children with them. I mean, to this day, President Obama has said many times, you know, my parents' marriage was illegal, was against the law in many of the states. They couldn't travel to many of the states. That continues to be a significant issue. There is still a lot of resistance. Some of it has to do with foreigners. Some of it has to do with race in the country, you know, where there's still just strong sentiment against that. There's a fear of mixing, you know, of that kind of...
So you're saying the story was a reaction to the idea that the Jewish people, the Jewish men should divorce their wives, was sort of argument against that.
Exactly. It becomes a really significant corrective to that view that says that the way to be faithful as a nation is to get rid of all foreigners and become pure. And this story comes to show, and we'll see that. We'll build that argument as we go.
That continues. That's always a theme in Judaism for a long time. You know, to keep it pure. I mean, it's even now in Israel, you know, there's a whole deal with the Arabs. You know, can the Arabs live, the Israeli citizens? All that, you know, destroy the city.
Yeah, and I'm not sure to say that it's particular to Judaism. I think, you know, there's, for example, you know, to give an example of something that's at the root of some of the, you know, the laws in the United States about, you know, one drop of blood. I mean, you know, purity, the concern for racial purity, in the way we conceptualize of it today is very different from what would have been happening here. And so we have to be very mindful of that. This is not necessarily racial purity. There is certainly, I think... is not particular to Judaism to have the sense of how do we become more faithful? Is it through purity, or are there other ways? You know, are there external ways in which we can express it? We can see it more clearly in Judaism because sometimes it's foreign to us. We see it differently, and it seems like kosher and keeping kosher seems kind of over the top. But we have other ways of keeping purity in our own culture and in our own tradition. I mean, the move in the United States towards English only. You know, even though, I mean, it's based on a false assumption. You know, immigrants today learn English quicker than any prior generation ever has. In part because kids are required to be in school. So the second generation, you know, the kids who are born here or come as children, 100% of them will learn language. For the immigrant community, for Hispanic community, often it's a concern, actually, that children lose the language too quickly. You know, in a way that it never has happened before. My father-in-law is Finnish, background. He is third generation, born in the United States, and didn't learn any English till he went to school. His mother never learned it, even though she was born and raised in the United States. You know, they were up in Wolf Lake, Minnesota, Virginia, Minnesota, you know, where you're from. Well, those things will say a lot to people who are from Minnesota. Yes. All these isolated Finns out there. But some of these things reflect a similar approach. And the question is, how...
Well, I was just saying that it didn't... Although this story was written and included in the Bible, it didn't override that whole.
I think what it showed.
It didn't like win the battle completely forever. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it shows that within Judaism, both just like within other traditions, both currents run strong. Mm-hmm. You know, there is very strong currents within Judaism that call for, you know, integration and for a. You know, the openness and the clarity about the fact that the people of Israel are like to the nations. That is, you know, that there's a wider connection, but there's also within it a current that says
also the
isolations of it.
The Samaritans in the New Testament, they were the like bad Jews or something.
Exactly, because it has to do with, you know, when they were taken into exile, who stayed, and whether they mixed or not. So mixing is always a problem.
When Ruth was included in the biblical canon, do you think that the church leaders who created the canon understood this about Ruth as a corrective? Because that was a long time ago, and I wonder if it was included, or this is a more recent realization that Ruth is the corrective.
You know, I think that it's interesting to try to figure out, you know, within Judaism, because certainly we're looking at a Hebrew canon, and so, you know, Christianity adopted that canon. They kind of developed kind of at the same time in the early century, because there hadn't been a need to sort of say we're going to print, you know, there wasn't a need to print a book that was a Bible. You know, there was kind of like sacred books that were kept in sacred spaces, and eventually there's all this terminology that begins to be used until we end up with a canon. Within the Christian tradition, the canon was not officially adopted within the Catholic Church until the Council of Trent, which is not until 1525. So, I mean, you know, part of it is we are so used to kind of seeing Bibles bounded and then this distinction between Christian Bible, I mean, Protestant Bible and Catholic Bible and all these things that we think this is a process that happened, you know, very narrowly, very quickly. It was over a long period of time. So the question, though, realizing that about the process of canonization of books, the complexity of it in long term, so there's not like, you know, at some point somebody sat down to decide. I think that one of the factors was the texts or the stories that were resilient and remained significant to the community. So what we can say about it is that it was a book that remained consistently significant to the community. Was it read in this way? I don't think that you could avoid it. I think that what we see in the beginning here, look at what's happening in the story just in these first five verses. When you're hearing the story as a Jew, the Moabites, blah, they killed the three guys. I mean, they're not going to wonder too much about it. You know, we sent this good family out there and they killed them all. So there's an anger that is intended at the beginning of the story towards these foreigners. Can't you see? It's obvious, right? They say to each other, they're terrible. That's what happens. Don't migrate. Don't mix. They're terrible. That's the way the story seems to begin. And it draws people in the way that Nathan draws David in. Let me tell you a little story, you know, about this guy and his sheep. And we will get to the point where the story will say, you are the man. You know, once you're into the story and getting all angry about the Moabite, you're going to end up with this Moabite wife who you're supposed to divorce in the lineage of Jesus himself. Because she becomes a grandmother to David. And the women at the end of the story repeat this clearly. So that I don't think this is necessarily, you know, a modern reading of the text, you know, so to speak. I really think that's, to me, you know, once you consider the context of it, that this would have been an outrageous story, you know, whether how intentionally it was brought in at that point is harder to debate, you know. It's really difficult to debate biblical text. It's just, you know, the people who do that work have other reasons why they do it. And that pretty drama. All right.
Was it part of the Jewish
Torah? Sure, yeah. I mean, because, okay. You know, Christians mostly just adopted the Hebrew.
So it would have been in the scrolls.
Mm-hmm. One of the ones that was...
So they consider it part of their...
Oh, yeah, definitely. So the placement of it is different, but all of the order of the books in the Hebrew Bible is slightly different, but the books are the same that we use in the Protestant canon. It's taken from the Hebrew scriptures. So. Okay, a couple of other things that I thought was interesting. I did this, just reading of this text with a group of immigrant women in Yakima Valley a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that they noticed, two things that they noticed that we haven't necessarily kind of addressed, they've gotten to, but I'll mention them here. One of them is that they all moved together. You know, this was a huge decision to move in a time of risk to a foreign land. It's one thing for a couple to do this, but to move with their children, that's a huge issue. And these women were very attentive to that because many people have, many of them have moved here undocumented, have criticized them for bringing their children with them, for putting their kids in that kind of a risk. And their answer is clear. We had no choice. I mean, the choice is for our kids to die, you know, of starvation, of no opportunity, of violence. I mean, many of them made this very difficult choice. So they were very attentive to the fact that the whole family moves and takes this huge risk. Perhaps out of faith, it depends on how people interpret it. Some will have interpreted it that way, as courageous and faithful. Some might see it as just reckless.
Well, something to look at is, while they were their children, it doesn't specify the ages of the sons.
Mm-hmm.
And in Jewish culture, it was extremely common for, you know, families to live together up into their 40s. Mm-hmm. You know, the sons into their 40s. And so, you know, they may have had just as much choice.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been an entire family, you know, decision to go and do that.
Well, if you look at the rest of the story, there's two things to think about. I think that, you know, the choice of children is very much of a modern, you know, idea. The fact that you're going to get your keys when you're 17 and you have a car wasn't exactly a part of the culture then, of course. And so, families didn't choose to leave. Actually, men never left the family, even if they got married. What they did is they brought their wives into the family. That's part of what becomes significant in the story, because then this family has no place to go. For Ruth to stick with Naomi really means to stick with her for nothing because she has nothing to offer her, and she tells them that just as we keep reading, you know. So the boys would have been part of the family, and if they had any future at all, it would have been with her family. So there isn't exactly a choice for them, no matter what their age is, you know, to sort of remain behind unless they were already married and then had, you know, access to land, had already been granted, or some way like that for them. So, but it is hard. I mean, it's hard to say, I don't know how old the kids were when they traveled. You know, it's unclear how long they were there. What's significant, though, is that the family is a huge, you know, that migration, it redefines who the family is. For many immigrants, the family becomes the nuclear family, which is common to the culture in the United States oftentimes for many parts of the culture, but it isn't the case for other cultures sometimes. I mean, and I'm not making the distinction so clear, but the sense is that when people ask me about my family, I usually now will talk about my children and my wife, you know, but really, in this case, they are having to make some kind of distinction between the extended family and the nuclear family that moves. And migration has that impact often on families, you know. It kind of, you figure out who you're going to move with. A very different migration from Abraham and Sarah. Mm-hmm. If you remember, picked up the whole boat. I mean, they did leave their family. They leave your father's house, some of that. But he carries a much larger party with him. So,
You know, we might want to be hard on Elimelech and say, well, why didn't you go first by yourself? But like many of the biblical migrations, this probably happened in the dead of night because Naomi's family would probably try to prevent her from going to the Moabite territory. You know, and that some families will prevent the children from going so that at least they can grow up in the, you know, that so that the whole family probably went in the dead of night so that when their relatives woke up in the morning, they were gone.
And that, you know, and again, this is the kind of, I think, you know, in Jewish tradition, there is this midrash is basically where you sort of fill in the blanks. So this is part of what we're doing here. And we have to do it in a very gracious way to know that, I don't know, but this is a possibility. And I think the stories were told to help people think about that. You know, the absence of details is intentional in this beginning part to get all of this going in our mind. I'll wrap it up with a couple of things just because I'm mindful of time here. But the fact that Elimelech chooses to go with his family, leaving so much behind, forced by all of these contexts of a famine, of, you know, the time of the judges and the conflict that is there, the fact that the man disappeared is hugely significant because that's another significant element in immigration, that there is a separation not only of the nuclear family, perhaps from the extended family, but a missing of men. In the group I worked with a couple of weeks ago, all of the women in the group were having to parent their children on their own for a wide variety of reasons. Migration has hugely negative impacts oftentimes on the fact that men are the ones who maybe go first. And if they're away from family for long extended periods of time, sometimes like having history prior will, you know, start new families in a new place, disassociate from the families behind. I'm originally from Guatemala. Many of the towns in Guatemala where migration has shaped those communities are towns with no men. Entire towns where most of the men have migrated either into the larger cities to work or they have migrated north, you know, in search of work. And so part of what the women, it was interesting reading this book with this group of immigrant women, because to them also, the question about why the men weren't there didn't really matter all that much. The reality is men are gone. For one of them, deported. For another one, her husband was deported. For another one, it was a divorce, an abusive situation. For another one, the husband had died. For another one, she had had children, and her husband never recognized them and abandoned them early on. Whatever the reason was, this particular group of women that got together for the study all lived on their own and could hear the story in a very different way. I appreciate the time today, and I invite you as we, you know, we'll see where we're able to go, if depending on what happens in the next 3 days with Bible study. If we end up together, we'll continue reading through it together. If not, I do encourage you and invite you to read the text on, with some of these, you know, sort of attentiveness to the details, not only of what's there, but what's also missing. So would somebody like to close us in a word of prayer?
Let us pray. Good and gracious God, we give you thanks for this chance to be together and to look into this sacred story and learn not only about what happened thousands of years ago, but what's happening around us and among us now, and how you continue to use your people. We give you thanks for the imaginations you give us to ask the questions and fill in the blanks and make the story our own. Bless us as we continue to struggle with your word. May it open up new possibilities for us. All this we lift to you in Jesus' name.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you.